So who with the resistance?
Hello, what have we here?
I'm a big deal in the resistance.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Resistance Radio. It's episode 89. Hope you all enjoyed last week's show, because this week it's all about The Last Jedi. And warning, this episode is completely full of spoilers. So if you have not seen The Last Jedi, turn this off now. But as always, I'm Mikey B, and I'm joined by my co-host, Danya.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to a post-The Last Jedi world.
I know, right? Welcome. And we also have Mikal joining us today. How you doing, Mikal?
Hi. I don't know how I feel.
Oh, that's okay. We'll get into that.
I woke up very confused.
I think a few people may have done that, too. And Ben, how are you doing today, Ben?
I'm doing well. If we're already in a non-spoiler zone, Ben doesn't die in this movie. I'm just very happy.
Well, last episode said there might be more than one Ben. We didn't get more than one Ben, but we got someone else, too. If you want to get involved in the conversation, you can get a hold of us on Twitter at Our Radio Podcast. Leave a comment on our Facebook page. Send us an email through our website, resistanceradio.net, or leave a comment on this post when it goes up on hypebolt.com. Today's podcast is brought to you by audible.com. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/resistanceradio. With over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player, get the latest Star Wars audiobook for free, including Cobalt Squadron, that came out today, which I haven't started listening to, and the Canto Bight book. Like, I love how like all the stuff has come out like recently. So like, I'm sure Ben has the soundtrack and everything too that came out today, and everything just is coming out today. I'm excited.
I'm really excited to read Cobalt Squadron because
Paige.
We'll get to Paige in a second.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, we also launched our Patreon. Check it out at patreon.com/resistanceradiopodcast. Supporting us is very helpful just because it does cost us some money to run a podcast and release episodes every week. Some perks include joining us on Discord chat, recording studio where you can be in here and tell us what you think of The Last Jedi as we record, movie nights and After Dark episodes. If you can't afford to support us via Patreon, that's cool. We also have merch for sale. T-shirts and buttons are available on our website. So, I think it's time to talk about The Last Jedi. All right, before we dive into it, I think you're right. Maybe we do need to go character by character because there's just so much going on, right?
Yeah.
Danya?
This is why I broke it down. I think we need to
go through just a pulse check real quick, starting from the top down. What was your general thoughts on the, like, feelings? Do you like it? Not like it? Kind of conflicted? Don't know what happened? Like, you feeling awkward? Let's start with you, Mikal. I know you started off in our show intro about how you feel about it. So tell us what you thought about The Last Jedi.
Gosh. I had a very strange experience that began with getting displaced from my theater because they had booked the theater for a private screening. So everybody who was supposed to see the movie in that theater had to go to a different, like, showing, and they weren't sure where, and it was a whole mess. But, I don't know. I definitely reacted a lot. Like, I had the, like, gas moments. I'm, like, sitting forward in my seat. I'm like, oh my gosh, what the hell? Like, it definitely affected me viscerally. But at the same time, I thought some of it was kind of silly, and a lot of it didn't, like, it kind of didn't go anywhere, or it spent a really long time not going anywhere, and then it finally got somewhere, and we were there at that place for a very brief period of time. So, I don't, like, my overall impressions are not positive, but that could just be because I was sitting next to my sister, who really didn't enjoy it. I don't know. I'm so confused. I kind of feel like I just want to, like, go up to somebody and be like, what are your feelings? Okay, those are my feelings, too.
All right. Danya, you've had a day to digest it. What are your opinions on The Last Jedi?
I really liked it. I do have, like, very minor niggles and issues with it in certain points. Like, I think Mikal is right in that a couple of scenes went on too long, or they held something for a beat too long, and what would have been, like, it needed, like, I think in some places another pass at editing. And so there are some little bits that kind of, like, frustrated me. But on the whole, I really enjoyed it. Like, the characters, some of the actual story, some of the reveals, I think. We were doing, like, a little bit of a pre-show chat between me and Ben because we got in a little bit early. And I was saying that it was really interesting that it played on expectations of being quite thematically similar to Empire, but then kind of veered off completely. So it kind of played on those expectations where people were like expecting it maybe to be a little bit more like Empire, and then it was like, psych, not really. But on the whole, I really liked it. I know that I've seen a couple of people really frustrated with Rey's story, and the thing with Rey's story is that I think I had a very specific take on it that left me, like, really devastated and really affected in, like, a good way. So we'll obviously get to that and have, like, a really in-depth discussion about it, but I have, like, a really long article planned for Hypeable about it as well.
All right. And Ben, what are your thoughts on The Last Jedi?
Cool. So I'm going to read off everything I jotted down after seeing the movie, but before going to sleep, really quick. Yeah, this was definitely the boldest Star Wars movie, I think, hands down. It kind of, like, shattered expectations in a lot of ways. Because it's, like, a Rian Johnson movie, and then it's a Star Wars movie. Or at least that's what I felt. And it's kind of, like, I went in with some expectations that were given to me by The Force Awakens, and they were, like, shot down. And I think that's why people are upset. But if you go in without those expectations, I think it's really enjoyable. You know, like, his play on nostalgia. Like, the Leia tape that R2 plays for Luke kind of got to me a little bit. I kind of agree with the whole, like, I could have had another pass at editing, because I thought, like, on the whole, it was weird. The whole movie felt too fast, but also way too slow. Kind of like a Lord of the Rings movie, sort of. You know, especially, I don't know, because, like, the balance between the characters was very, like, Lord of the Ringsy, where, like, Rey is kind of not the main character anymore. It's kind of an ensemble cast now. And, you know, so now we've got this shift from, like, Rey's trilogy to, like, this is an ensemble trilogy. And I think that is also kind of jarring, because we all went in, we're like, what's Rey gonna do? And even though this is a lot about her, you know, it's sort of like a Rey, Luke, Kylo Ren story now. But yeah, I mean, I was also, again, Danya was saying we were talking before the show, and I think, like, the whole, you know, it's a lot funnier than I thought it would be. So, like, it feels more like the kind of original, it's a Star Wars movie, it's for all ages, it's supposed to be this fun adventure flick. And I think, like, because movies like Revenge of the Sith exist, we kind of expect, like, oh, it's going to be dark, and we expect that kind of dark. You know, so I think, you know, that's something I think people maybe weren't expecting to grapple with, which is why people weren't ready to grapple with it. I enjoyed it, but again, it is a huge shift from, like, Force Awakens alone, you know, let alone the rest of the saga. Yeah, but I was overall happy with it. I mean, of course, all of us probably have something we want to talk about that's not necessarily good in our minds, but I mean, like, what movie doesn't have that?
I'll agree with you. You know, overall, I personally liked it a lot. I enjoyed it. It's a good film, I think. But it's an interesting film, because it feels like Star Wars, but it does things so different. Like, Danya, you mentioned, it feels like Empire Strikes Back, at least thematically, but it doesn't do anything like Empire Strikes Back. So it does things so differently. So it's good. I think I need to see it a few more times to properly digest it. I will say, my biggest thing with it is it doesn't feel like it's a phenomenal film. Like, I'm going to see it. I already plan to see it two more times this weekend. But it's one of those things where it doesn't feel like, whereas, like, Force Awakens was good, although it mirrored the original trilogy a little too much, maybe some people would argue, but I enjoyed that. And Rogue One was, like, a surprise kind of hit. Like, it just was really good as a story and everything. And then this one, like, think of, like, all 9 films that are out now. You know, everything from the prequel trilogy, the original trilogy, this new you know, these two films from this trilogy and Rogue One. Where would you place this film in that number, in that numbered list? For me personally, it's actually way down there as I was thinking about it. You know, if, I think in my order of favorite films, one has to be Empire, then A New Hope. And then I'm kind of a toss between Force Awakens and Rogue One at the number three spot. Three and four, I guess. And then Return of the Jedi, and then Revenge of the Sith. And then I think Last Jedi is right after Revenge of the Sith, story-wise and film-wise, that I like. And then obviously Phantom Menace and Attack of the Clones, you know, rounding that out. But just because it's lower on that list doesn't mean it's not a good film. What would you, if you guys had to rate it, where do you guys think it would fall in that list of nine?
That's a very good question. I hadn't actually thought about it. Because the problem with, like, the rewatchability of some of the Star Wars films is that the majority, well, for the most part, then, I should say, it's very much, the rewatchability comes down to how much joy you derive from it. Like, sometimes rewatching a film over and over and over again, it's all about invoking that feeling of, like, joy, happiness. Even if it has, like, darker moments, it's easy to rewatch. Whereas this one took on a much darker tone. It had a lot of humor that, personally, I really appreciated, because it was the kind of humor that I actually really like and enjoy, because it was on the slightly darker side. But
it's true to Star Wars humor too.
But it really is. Like, it completely fits in. Everything from C-3PO going like, "I can't be part of your mutiny" type thing, to you know, Chewie trying to be Chewie, always thinking with his stomach, you know?
Yeah. There were bits of it, but, like, for me, because it's, we'll get into it, I think, when we talk about the Rey and Kylo story, but there was a seriousness to this film that linked in directly with the conversation that is going on in the public eye right now about abusive relationships and stuff like that, that really makes this a thinking film, which I think makes it more difficult to rank. Because for me, I think I would set it to one side. I don't know that I can rank it in with the other movies the way that I can rank the rest of the Star Wars saga films. Yeah. Because there's so much to, like, digest in terms of, I think this is the film that really focused on that historical and cyclical abuse storyline that has been prevalent in Star Wars the whole way along, but did it in a way that was very different.
Because, well, it's also kind of, if you weren't looking for it necessarily, you wouldn't have noticed, which I think is, I think that's good filmmaking, because then, like, you can get it, if that's what you want out of the movie, you can get it out of the movie.
I genuinely don't understand how people missed, or how people could have missed Kylo Ren's manipulation and abuse of Rey and taking advantage of her grief and isolation. Like, I genuinely don't understand how people.
But I think I would almost argue how you read it. Like, just as the film is, you know, light and dark. She also had a non-manipulative way to be of him, but she also had a way of trying to turn him. You know, she wanted to change him too. So, like, obviously, they're two, you know, they're portrayed in the film as both light and dark. Snoke even says it, as his power rise, you know, her power rise. But they both have a different way of doing the same thing, but from a different perspective.
Right. I think the audience sides with her because, obviously, she's on the good side.
Yeah, it's
yeah,
it's,
I also, it's, I think it, like, it depends on how you see Kylo, honestly, because I think that, like, I don't view him as much, like, intentionally, like a long-standing plot to manipulate Rey. I think he's a manipulative person and a manipulative in a situation that you know, definitely rewards manipulation. But I think that he is also being manipulated by Snoke. I think that's the whole point of the revelation at the end, that, like, oh, I connected your minds. This wasn't some random force thing. And, like, I think that ultimately he doesn't make the decision to throw that off. Like, the ironic thing is he's like, oh, you're holding on to the past, where he is actually the one who is like, oh, I'm the new Vader, I'm continuing this cycle. And she is, well, I guess also continuing the Jedi, but I don't see it as much as, I mean, and this is just because I like, I have an inexplicable soft spot for Kylo Ren anyway. But I don't see the whole, his whole arc in the movie as just like bringing Rey to the dark side. I think that he is also struggling with things. And because I think that, like, I really did like the three different versions of like the clash between him, the final moments between him and Luke. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that it was very powerful to get like what Luke feels happened, what Kylo really does perceived. Think happened. He woke mm-hmm. up with Luke standing over him with a lightsaber, and then what actually happened, which was somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, I love that. Like, in my mind, every time we saw a different version, I'm like, from a certain point of view, this is what happened. Like, mm-hmm. just thinking back to the whole thing. Yeah, I think the whole idea of Kylo and Rey, just because they're being manipulated by Snoke, if anything, from the get-go, is it's a different take on both of them and what they're doing. But let's move into our character. I guess the easiest way to discuss the film is by character. Let's start with none other than General Leia Organa. So, how do you guys think she was used in The Last Jedi? Do you think she was underutilized? It was perfect for what, you know, the story ended up telling? Thoughts?
Who would like to go first?
I can
wait,
go.
Who talks
I
first?
Go.
You talk first? I talk first. I talk
first. I'll
talk first. Hello, I'm waiting for General Hux. Yes, I'll hold. No?
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway.
I was that person in the movie who kind of had the loudest belly laugh at the beginning, and people started laughing at me. But I was having a good old time at that opening.
There was one guy in my theater who like kept on like just yelling random stuff out. So like at one point, way before Yoda turned up, he was like, "Where's Yoda?" I was like,
sad.
Dude.
And then everyone in the theater would be like, snap, when he comes up. All right, anyway, let's get back to General Leia. Come on. Okay, folks, discussion, okay, or we'll be here for like 4 hours.
I can start if we can. All right. If you want to. Okay.
Go, Ben. You.
I've heard people say that she was not in the movie as much as they wanted, but then I thought about it, and like, everybody kind of has equal screen time. And that mm-hmm. amount of screen time is not a whole lot, because there are so many characters. So after I kind of thought that, I was like, no, I thought she was used well. I think, even though it was a little over the top, her big moment in this movie, which happens towards the beginning, my theater reacted so well that I was like, yup, this is happening. I'm okay with this. Like, it was kind of this big, like, I don't know. It's confirmation of a lot of things we wanted from Leia from the get-go. Mainly that she's Force sensitive. But, I liked her a lot in this movie. Yeah, exactly. Uses it differently. But I enjoyed Leia in this movie a lot. I think she felt more like Leia in this movie than in Force Awakens. But maybe that's just because, you know, we had her from start to finish and like got to see her, you know, leading the rebellion, which is kind of what she does. And also just kind of like snapping at Poe. Like everything she did was very like, okay, this is Leia. This is the Leia I remembered from, you know, Return of the Jedi. So,
I will say, I feel the way they utilized her was interesting because she was a mix of Leia that we know from the original trilogy and a Leia that we got from Bloodlines and a more mature Leia. You know, specifically, even at the beginning when they, you know, when Poe specifically says, hey, we have the opportunity to destroy a dreadnought. This is, you know, fleet destroyers. And she's like, but at what cost? And, you know, I guess you can say that the destruction of that the dreadnought was a victory for the resistance. But again, you know, her last act of duty was to, excuse me, to, you know, demote Poe specifically because at what cost? Like every single bomber was destroyed.
Yeah.
In that, every single bomber. And, you know, that was not, you know, not against them trying, but it was just one of those things where, so I think she's grown, you know, like you see her as, not the princess, not just a general, but as more almost a mother figure heading over, you know,
she's 30 years older. I mean,
yeah. So, you know, she's had the ability.
She would mature.
And she, you know, and also just like when you go through like her whole story arc, the fact that she even recognized that her son, you know, after the loss of, you have to, the biggest thing to remember in this film, and I had to remind myself, was unlike every other film where there's a time gap between the films, at least a little bit, this takes place immediately following The Force right. Awakens. So she still, you have to remember, she's still grappling with the loss of her husband, Han. even though he's been away from her for a while. And she also comes to the realization that her son is completely gone. There's nothing, you know, she can do, Luke can do, Han couldn't do it. Like, Ben is gone. And obviously, you see his story arc as he, you know, as he grows from it. You know, he definitely becomes the new supreme leader and everything. So to me, I feel like they utilized her correctly for it. I do love that she had some fun things, specifically her use of the Force, which I think we'll talk about in a second, which I think was also probably one of the most interesting spoilers, you know, in the film. And then also just, you know, her kind of the humor from her, where like when Poe tries to take the bridge and she's the one that comes out and he kind of lets his guard down and she just shoots him. It's like, boom. You know, I thought that was really
I love that moment.
Yeah, I love that cool. moment as well.
So
yeah.
She's just the like, you know,
it's great.
Yeah, and it's just like, it's one of those things where she has this relationship with, you know, Emmeline Holdo and with Poe, and they're very different relationships with the two of them. And it's one of those things where it's very easy to see that she is the mother figure to Poe. But at the same time, she's also this mentor to Holdo, and, you know, and she, you know, and she even says, like, use my security codes when you call for reinforcements. And it's her is going to, she's going to be the icon, which I will say my biggest thing about her character and the whole story arc she has in this film is we were told she was supposed to have a bigger part in episode 9. And obviously with the passing of Carrie Fisher, that's not going to be possible. It makes it really hard because you can tell they set that up for her story wise.
I think after seeing it and like thinking about it for a while, I think the easiest way to kind of make episode 9 feel organic is to have it take place years later and just say, like, you know, in the title crawl, like, you know, Leia learned to be one with the Force because we know she's super Force sensitive, and then, you know, we can kind of just take that as canon,
whatever you want. Yeah,
yeah,
Danya?
Yeah, I think Leia for me in this movie was I think they used her actually just the right amount, like, just they played well to Carrie's skills. They didn't like push it too much, and they allowed her to have that emotional impact without necessarily being front and center the whole time. And I also I kind of feel like this is the Leia who's actually earned all of the brashness and like bossiness that she has in the originals. You know, like, that girl's 19. You know, and this lady is you know, an elder statesman at this point, and stateswoman. And so to me, it felt very much like she had come into her own. Also, her whole look was so much better than it was in The Force Awakens.
Yeah, like, her look was on point in this film. She looked incredible. Yeah, I agree with Michal. I think that they used her the right amount in this film.
I will say, I loved that she used the Force, but I didn't like how it looked. Like,
the flying through space.
Scene was actually, when I was saying that it needed another edit, this scene in particular was the one I was thinking about. Because while I appreciate what it meant, and this scene should have been the moment where everyone realized that the Force just isn't for the Jedi, and it's not just entirely about, like, the Skywalker legacy as well. Like, she doesn't need to be a Jedi to use it. This is the scene that should have made people twig, finally, that, like, oh, this is gonna be slightly different. But
you gotta
went
remember
on way too long.
Well, before that
was so long.
Before that, too, Luke even talked about, you know, complaining about the Jedi, and with Rey to understand what the Force is. She already had her first lesson. You can see that the Force is not for the not just for the Jedi. But I will say, it's not really a surprise, because if you think back to, like, Return of the Jedi, he tells Leia, "You'll learn to use the power that I have." You know, when he reveals that, you know, he's hit her brother. So it's not surprising that she has the ability to use the Force. And if anything, you know, I think the biggest complaint is no one's ever seen Luke use an ability like that. But you got to remember, she's not really flying. She's just in space where there's no gravity anymore.
Yeah, so she simply justified it. I was like, yeah, I'm weird. Like, but then again, we've never seen somebody force float through space, so yeah, I can't like really
we've
judge it.
We've seen like Luke float at the end of this film. We've seen Rey move the the rocks and stuff like that. So in my mind, it kind of looked like
outer space. Like she's frozen, through outer space, so like she can't really move.
Yeah,
she's more just like psychically powering herself toward a thing. I just didn't like that she was like frozen in one position, like with a hand outstretched. Like it just didn't look right to me, and it went on
way too long.
Yeah, like
that it was. I think the awkwardness came from how long it was. Not taking away from the fact that it was incredibly badass, and I loved that moment. It went on two beats too long.
Yeah, meaning of the moment contrasted with the visuals and the length of the scene.
Yeah, see, I think the biggest thing is this is a scene. I don't know. Have any of you guys seen it more than once already, or no?
No.
Okay. Well, I don't know.
Less than 24 hours ago.
Well, I know people who've seen it twice already. The reason why I asked this is because I'm almost wondering because when I saw that, I didn't feel like it was too long when I saw it, and when I think about it now. I feel like it was too long, so I'm wondering if it's.
I felt it was way too long when I was sitting there. I like in my head, I was going, "Whoa, this needs to be shortened significantly." Yeah.
Really, her death. What you thought was her death, or you knew she wasn't going to die?
I knew that she wasn't going to die.
Because for me, I think the pace on it for me felt right because it was like, oh my gosh, is she really going to die this early on? I didn't think she was going to, but I'm like, you never know what they re-edited for the movie to make, going forward. And it's one of those things where as you see her move and you see it, you're kind of like, you breathe that sigh of relief and then she's at the door and they let her in. So I don't feel like the pacing when I saw it in film was bad, but like thinking about it now, I'm like, man, it felt like it was just a long time. You had to see her hand twitch and then she had to go in and then they let her in and then, she drops the beacon that Finn picks up, so I don't know. I found it very interesting. And I think after a couple more viewings, I'll have a final opinion on it. But for the most part, like, I think it's a good. It's something nice to have seen Leia actually use the Force, because we saw her use it in The Force Awakens when Han died. We saw her feel it. We knew she had the connection to the Force. Obviously she's Luke's sister and, he has told her, but she never actively became a Jedi or anything like that. I do want to move on specifically from there to a character that is not in our order here. I want to talk about Finn real quick, because I want to talk about Finn. He picks up that beacon from Leia after that scene specifically, and then what does he try to do? He tries to leave because he doesn't want Rey to come into what's essentially a dying fleet, or what he thinks to, and that's when he meets Rose.
Are we gonna go into Finn and Rose, or just
not? Yeah, well, that's okay. I was gonna move into that
we're not talking about Leia's relationship with Poe or Amelin.
I think we'll talk about that when we talked about Amelin and Poe, since that's important. I don't know if you guys want to talk about the relationship with Poe and not talk about Poe specifically individually. I feel like
we hit on the Poe Leia thing. Yeah. I mean, I feel like, I don't know, Poe felt like I don't want to say a stand-in for like a new son essentially for her, but like she kind of treats him like he's a kid.
Wants to
discipline him to the point of making sure he also doesn't, become a Sith. I mean, of course that's not going to happen, but like that's kind of how I felt. About their relationship.
Yeah, well, it's also like, you see Poe grow and learn throughout the, when you look at story arcs, when you look at General Leia's relationship to Amelin Holdo and Poe, it's really interesting. They're the same relationship, but they're at different points in that relationship. Specifically, if you take a look at Poe, he's still learning, and he doesn't understand the cost of life and the loss. He is definitely a pilot, and he's got an ego and everything. Whereas Amelin Holdo, you see her. For me, I thought she was a bad leader because she just keeps going until her whole plan was revealed, and then obviously her stake at the end. And so she, her whole point was like she's the first one says, we need to be the spark that light, that lights the resistance and everything like that. So her point is to like we need to survive. We need to move on to fight another day, even if it's not fighting right now. Poe doesn't see that. Whereas she's the one that stays behind after everyone else gets on. And you can see that it's because she even says she learned from Leia. So it's one of those things where she's at this point in a relationship with Leia, where she's a, if you think of Leia as a non-Jedi, but a leader, like a leader type thing, she has taught Holdo to be a leader. Whereas by the end of the film, you see Poe recognize what Luke is trying to do, and it's not fight right now with him, but to survive so they can fight another day. And that's exactly where, you know, her relationship with Poe is. You know, by the time in the film, her relationship with Poe has taught him to be a leader, which Holdo was at the beginning of the film. Would anyone agree or disagree on that?
No, I agree on that. I think it was really interesting to have Poe being, like, very brash. We even saw it, like, he's always been like that. He's very impulsive, and he tests the limits a lot. And you saw it in The Force Awakens when he was, like, confronted with Kylo. And it's that, I don't think it's necessarily that he hasn't needed to be confronted by loss. He's part of an X-Wing squadron, and he was a leader of that X-Wing squadron. And as we've seen, there's been significant loss across all of them. So I feel like he has recognized it, but for him, there was something about it that was also heroic. That dying in the line of battle, being active and taking the fight to the First Order.
The weight of the loss isn't there that it is with Emmeline and with Leia.
Yeah, because I think that he wasn't really looking beyond the immediate. He wasn't looking at what happened down the line in terms of, like, well, you don't have those forces behind you anymore. Not saying that, like, he's a bad character. Like, for him, he had very noble intentions, but he was very much an in-the-moment person and not taking the time to look at how that would have ramifications in the future.
Thing is, it's also, you know, I think the difference between Poe and Leia and Emmeline is, and to an extent, everybody else sort of deals with this too, is like, what do you value? Do you value victory or do you value survival? And do you value life? And Poe is, I guess, don't take this the wrong way, but kind of, it's a very macho idea of, like, you know, victory at all costs and, you know, whatever. And, like, he's literally yelling at these bombers to keep going as, like, they're dying. And, you know, it's very, you know, in the opening scene, which leads me to my other comment, which is that this movie is a bloodbath. Like, I mean, so many people die in this movie. It's kind of insane. But I think, you know, everybody is kind of focused on that, and like Rose's comment at the end to Finn is very much in that vein. It's like, we're fighting so that we can live and love and have a life. You know, it's not so that we get revenge. It's not so that we, you know, score some, like, oh man, Poe Dameron took down a dreadnought, you know. That's not the reason, and I think that Poe is confused and has to get straightened out in this movie forcibly, occasionally.
Yeah.
I'm just glad J.J. Abrams kept Poe in the first one, because we wouldn't have had this cool story arc without it.
Yeah, there's no glory in war, I think, is the thing. It's not, I think, about, he learns glory. That,
but you mean you would say wars not make one great? Said Yoda.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, I you know, when you look at it, I'll be honest, it's Poe's characterization is, he is still immature, and they even said it, like, he's a flyboy, he's got that arrogance to him, he's got that ego that anything can be resolved by hopping in his starfighter and shooting at stuff, which they actually call straight out, and Tesla says, hop in your starfighter and shoot at stuff right now. Like, that's what they need. There's time for that, and there's time that that's not the right choice, because you're right, at the beginning of the film, Poe disobeys a direct order, and we end up losing the entire of Kobol Squadron, including Rose's sister. And a lot of X-Wing pilots died during the time. Now, take it, there was, you know, they did destroy a dreadnought, which is amazing and good and all itself, but at the same time, like, at what cost is what happened there?
To me, honestly, I think that a lot of the Resistance's travails at the beginning of the movie, throughout the movie, go back to that decision, because, like, if they had had those other bombers, and their fleet, they would have been in a much stronger position to, you know, to stop the First Order from pursuing them almost to extinction, basically. And they would have been in a much stronger position even if they had been driven to Crait. So I think that it's really... I don't think the movie... I think the movie likes Poe, but I do not think that it endorses almost anything that he believes, certainly at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah, because I'm saying by the end of the movie, his character is like, oh, we need to escape and save people. Like, that was kind of his decision.
By the end of
the movie. Leia looks at him, and she's like, don't look at me, you know, because he finally makes the right decision. So it's nice to see that he had a very solid... I thought his character arc was probably my favorite in the movie, even if it wasn't the most important within the rest of the characters, you know?
No, I'll agree completely with that. So speaking of, you know, Poe's relationship growing and Leia kind of passing the torch to him, saying, well, don't look at me, follow him. What about the other leadership we had? We had Emmeline Holdo. So we kind of touched on it already, but how did you guys feel specifically about her as a leader?
I loved her. Like, completely and implicitly. I don't know if this is, like, a difference between, like, how you... I don't want this to come out the wrong way. It probably is going to sound really bad. I wonder a lot about how the view of women looking at Emmeline Holdo, her relationship with Poe and her relationship with leadership will differ significantly from how men view her and her leadership style and how she reacted with Poe. Because for me, looking at her, I saw her immediately recognize the kind of person Poe was, that he had a dangerous aspect to him, that was he in the know about specific things that were part of her strategy and plan, that he would probably scupper it and do something stupid, so she kept it on a very need-to-know basis, and did what was best for the fleet and put everything in order in order to get people to where they needed it to be. Like, I could see that very, very clearly looking at the film going, oh, she obviously knows her stuff. But then there were other people that I knew who had seen it, guys who had seen it, who felt the complete opposite, that she was, she was very cold, she was very secretive, they didn't trust her. And it was like, it was very interesting to see that difference.
Well, I think we're almost meant to see her being kind of standoffish without them, because we were getting information through Poe, you know, and Finn and Rose kind of did their own thing. Like, they created their own sync-up plan because they didn't know what else was going on. Now, by the end of the film, it was flat out pointed out that she knew what was going on. She had a plan. She just did not let him in on it.
And, yeah, exactly. And honestly, if I'd been in Amelin's position and Poe had been demoted and he was running around being as brash as he was and demanding answers, I would have done exactly the same thing.
I also, did anybody else feel that there was an implication that Poe didn't realize that she was a woman?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, because he's like, wait, that's her? You know, like, not how I pictured her. I thought
that was
her.
A reference to just the purple hair. I didn't realize.
It totally could be. Like, it's a subjective interpretation for sure.
Yeah,
but, like, I sort of thought that was part of what was going on.
You could also,
and obviously
take it as...
not that Poe is, like, sexist and can't take orders from women. Like, that's not true. Yeah. But I do think that he has, you know, Emmeline has a lot of history, and Poe is not, like, he doesn't particularly care about that history. He's kind of like, I know the ground so well, and, like, he's clearly expecting to be made commander, you know, and, like, or whatever rank it is, general. Mm-hmm. I think that relationship is very much based on each of their perceptions, and Amelin's are a lot closer to the truth than Poe's.
Yeah. I'm thinking from Poe's perspective, specifically as a character, I think he was probably surprised at the fact that, like, I think when he thinks general, even, I mean, like, if he knew her name, I think he was expecting, not necessarily like, oh my gosh, it's a woman, but I think, like, he was expecting, like, a Phasma kind of general, you know? Not like a purple-haired woman in a ball gown, because I feel like whenever you think of a general, you're like, oh, someone who's actually dressed for war. And so that was probably what caught him off guard. But I mean, I liked her costume. I thought it was awesome. Well. But again, that might have been part of it. I don't know. But I didn't really read it that way. I kind of saw the whole situation as like, you know, we're getting this information, like you said, through Poe. And so we feel kind of hostile towards her until we find out what she's actually doing. And then I'm like, oh, okay, great. Awesome. I like her a lot.
I felt frustrated at Poe. Like, I don't know if that... Was that just me, Michal? Did you feel the same way?
I didn't know how to feel, because I feel like from a really long time ago, like, possibly more than a year ago, I had heard some... Like, I try not to hear spoilers or anything, but somebody had said something about, like, oh, there's a spy in the rebel ranks or something. So that was playing in my mind the whole time, and I, like, didn't know if I was supposed to be, like, Poe's right and Amelin is really like a spy and is telling the First Order where they are. So I think watching it a second time, knowing that Amelin is completely on the level, I might have a different reaction.
Yeah, see, for me, I instantly saw that she was someone who had strength. She reminded me more of a Mon Mothma, if anything. But at the same time, like, I didn't necessarily agree with her decisions, especially because I wasn't getting any information. I believe that she knew what she was doing, but you know, you have to take, you know, especially if you have to take faith on something. I knew more about Poe than I knew about her. So yeah. In my mind, I'm thinking like, was Poe right? When you ask like, was Poe right to be frustrated with her? As a viewer, you know, even if you look at all Star Wars as a whole, where they have had strong women in leadership, you know, everyone from General Leia, who is obviously, you know, the leader of the resistance, and then she's injured, and then when, you know, you think Poe is going to get it, I'm like, oh, wow, this is going to be interesting, Poe, and then Amelin Holdo gets it, you're kind of like, okay, that's fine, that makes sense, because, you know, we had Mon Mothma before her and stuff like that, who led the attack on the Death Star, like, so she's going to bring level-headedness, especially when you look at Poe, who had just been demoted because he was not being very level-headed, but at the same time, you never get any any insight. So I think Poe had a right to be frustrated with her because he's used to being able to get more from Leia than what Holdo was giving him. I think he had a right to be frustrated with her. I don't think he had a right to pull a coup the way he did or attempted to. But at the same time, like, I think that could have been completely... I feel like that could have been completely negated if she simply realized that, hey, Poe is very passionate, and having someone passionate on your side is not a bad thing. When you consider that someone like Leia has used him, he is the best pilot in the Resistance. It's been said that multiple times. She has used him.
And that opening of the movie
proves it, right? And you also have stuff like, you also have that she sent him on the very important mission to find the, you know, to go see Lor San Tekka to get the map. She sent him on, you know, there's the whole Poe Dameron comics that we know. So, like, she has taken Poe as a confidant. You know, he's not at a level of Admiral Ackbar or Holdo in the ranks of the leadership. But it's one of those things where I think he has a right to be frustrated because he doesn't see any of that. He's not given anything. He's taken it back. So when you look at, like, think of like a boss or a leader. If you're meant to follow someone, he has to take it on pure blind faith that the chain of command knows what's right. But at the same time, like, if he just believed in it, is he any better than a stormtrooper who believes what is told then? Like, I think the questioning him being frustrated is a very unique Rebel Alliance resistance thing, and I think it's completely valid.
No. I'm somewhere in the middle, but I do agree that I think some of Amelin's character was sacrificed to mystery a little bit, you know, and like, because we don't know what's going on. We don't know if Poe is right or if she's right, and because we don't know her, we do kind of go like, oh, well, I guess Poe's right. Probably. Maybe. And then, you know, we get that switcheroo where obviously he is not. So I think that, like, a little bit more time spent with Amelin in the beginning, like, if we saw her before, it was suddenly like, ah, they need a new general, you know, then I think it would have helped.
Yeah, I would have liked to have spent more time with Amelin. This is another thing of the needing another pass at editing thing. I think that we needed a little bit more time with her in terms of, like, who her character is. I think because I'd read the Leia Princess of Alderaan book, like, almost immediately before I went to see it, I had a very good handle on who her character was and how she worked, because I'd only just read that book, like, the couple of days before seeing the film. So I went in there with that in my head, and guiding me in terms of, like, interpreting what she was doing. So I feel like that really helped me. But, I feel like in order to, like, solidify that, but, like, the general audiences, we should have spent a little bit more time with her. I would have liked to have seen interactions between Amelin and Leia a little earlier on. I thought that would have been really good in setting up those characters. Like, their relationship with each other and playing off each other, because as much as, like, I knew that going into the film because I'd read the book, it until you get, like, right to the end of the film, you don't understand that relationship much.
Yeah, you don't even know that they have this trust. And then they have this incredibly, like, intimate, like, sweet moment, and then it's like, you have to kind of, I also read the book, and you know, knew intellectually that they were friends, but, like, I almost felt like she could have just popped in there and been like, yep, me and Leia, best friends, know him forever.
You know? Yeah, like, I got, and like, anyone? Spinning upside down and doing some yoga type stuff, like, I felt like would have been her character.
The funny moment at the end when they're, like, talking to each other, and they're talking about Poe, and she's being all like, I'm really fond of him, but he's an idiot, but I'm really quite fond of him. And she's like, yeah, I get that. Like, I can see that. Did anyone else get a lesbian moms and their son vibe? Because I was like, oh my god. It was really funny. It was like two moms talking about their really problematic little son being a headstrong idiot.
I didn't get that vibe, but I do agree that it's like they kind of both, like, they saw where Poe was coming from. And I think it was one of those things where, like I said, if she had let Poe in because Leia had recognized it, I think this whole, like, debate of was Poe right, was she, you know, a strong enough leader, like, I don't think it would have even come up if she had simply done something a little bit different on that end. But at the same time, like, I, you know, especially when you can think that he had enough people behind him to actually mutiny and take the bridge. So, like, it should have been like, hey, like, the rebellion has always been somewhat more of a democracy and open, and this felt more like an actual war and something. So it was interesting when she took the leadership. But
that was, I mean, it goes both ways. So it's really interesting in that, because of Poe's relationship with Leia, this idea that Holdo needed to trust Poe implicitly works the other way around. Because Amelin and Leia obviously have that same trusting relationship, so why doesn't Poe trust her because of Leia? Like, it works both ways. And I think for Amelin, it makes more sense that she doesn't trust Poe because he'd just been demoted and pulled a stunt that lost all of their bombers.
I agree 100%. I think it's a matter of looking at different perspectives. So from a certain point of view, they're each right in their own regards. I do want to talk about her sacrifice as we move on, because we are drawn out here. I will say the fact that she decides not to, what would Poe say, like, run away and call her a coward, but to leave, but to stay on the ship to continue as they go on. And I will say, it's really interesting that, you know, we're not going to talk about him in too much detail, maybe for another episode, but DJ, you know, goes ahead and sees that uncloaks the small ships that her whole sacrifice was meant to, you know, draw out the First Order and have them pass. But DJ kind of spoiled her original plan. But that sacrifice of her going to light speed towards the ships and destroying them was kind of amazing.
Yeah, I was in floods of tears. Like, that scene, like, the actual bit where the impact happens on the ship and it just, like, it goes silent. Like, it's really odd. There were moments in this film where I thought the editing needed a lot of work, but that scene in particular, I thought the editing on it was impeccable. I thought that was such an incredible scene, and just, yeah, that whole bit where it, like, cuts to silence, and you just see.
Well, you also get it from different angles too. Yeah, which I thought was cool because they're like, this moment's too good to just have in one angle for like a couple seconds. So yeah, I definitely.
I will say, you know, you keep bringing up the editing in this film, and I agree. The editing in this film, I think, was set by the editing from Force Awakens, where time didn't really play directly across, especially when you look at, like, the final scene from The Force Awakens of Rey handing her, the lightsaber out to Luke. There are certain things that slow down, like this scene where, you know, the sacrifice with the ship going to light speed, whereas other things take or sped up, you know, just for the sake of time. So it's meant to kind of tell the cohesive story, but it's, you know, we even look at it with the Leia going from space, like that slowed down because honestly, if you think about it, she could not have been out there for as long as she was, but it was meant to be a dramatic moment. There's a pause when you think of the pacing of it. So it was interesting, but I will say that sacrifice, it was interesting to see it because I don't think I had ever thought of going through a ship and using it. I thought she was just going to ram them. I didn't realize she was going to use light speed to just like destroy her ship through it. I will say you've seen things like this happen before in different books. Like I believe in Rebel Rising, the book that shows Jyn Erso before what happened in Rogue One. She's with a family and their ship explodes in the process of going to light speed. So it destroys a bunch of things also. So it's one of those things where I feel like we've seen it before in previous novels, but never on screen. And I think it was just like a, oh, wow. She knew it, especially coming from like having her characterization from the Princess Leia novelization and seeing her in the film. Like I knew the character, but at the same time, I didn't like, they didn't kind of completely mesh from my picture of her in the book versus her in real life. But obviously 40 years have since passed since then. But seeing that, like that brought me back to Emmeline going through the, you know, the explorer on Alderaan climbing the mountain and someone hurting their foot and like wanting to help out. Like that brought me back to her being the Emmeline that we knew from the book originally. So that sacrifice was definitely great for her characterization for me as a whole, especially knowing her past and everything.
Yeah, I was like bummed that we were like clearly going to say goodbye to this character who we had really just gotten to know, like not even over the course of the movie, more like over the course of like 10 minutes. But I can't, I mean, like to me, and I make up stories about the way movies are made sometimes. And for me, my story about this movie is that, like, the parts that Rian Johnson clearly had in his head for a really long time are spectacular. I think of this scene, I think of Crait. Like, I think he even said that Crait was one of the first locations he came up with, and that, to me, is, like, just so beautifully vivid and interesting and new.
It stays in your head.
It really does, and, yeah. Like, just the visuals of, like, the red underneath the white, and... but I think that, you know, there are a lot of parts that were more just like, and then this happens, and like those are not as clear. They don't come across as clearly on screen. I won't go into those now, but I think that Amlin's death is a major highlight, and while I'm bummed, I like at least it's a character that like you know they went out in amazing fashion. Like that is like a bummer, but a completely worthy death.
Yeah, if we're going on favorite deaths in Star Wars, that's probably... I would need to think about it, but it's really high.
It's up there with Obi-Wan for me.
It's, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. It's definitely going to be an iconic death, you know, something like that. Moving on, real quick to Poe Dameron. We definitely want to talk a little about his humor. I will say, it was really interesting to see that right from the get-go, you know, I will say if you look at the film and look at the trailers, like, we got almost everything at the very beginning of the film that we saw in the trailers. And seeing Poe start off the same way he did with, you know, Force Awakens, holding for Hux, like, it was... Yeah. I mean, it was like, it was the perfect... And then Hux goes into his speech multiple times, I am General Hux, blah, 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 blah. And then, like, it's like, I'm holding for Hux.
General Hux, pasty guy.
Like, it was amazing.
Did anyone get, like, a Loki Hulk vibe from that whole conversation?
No.
I didn't get that. I'm a big bad guy and you need to respect me. And he was like, no, I won't. Like, I don't know, that kind of exchange. I guess it was a verbal version of the, what I would, I don't know. Huck's had a very Loki kind of character vibe in this movie from the I'm evil but also comedic perspective. And I really liked it. I don't know. I know some people may not have, but
no, I agree with you. I think I will say the biggest thing is I think this kind of characterizes who Poe is. You know, we saw this from the very first, you know, in the very first one when him and Kylo Ren are kind of like, who speaks first? I speak first, you speak first. Like that definitely set the tone for his character in the very first film. And in this one, like it's really funny. It's like, it had to be like an underling to Huck saying, I think he's putting you on, sir. And it's like, fire! Like, just like, he's so frustrated. And it, like, the best part is, like, it also speaks something to Artemidge Hux. Because if you've read the Phasma novel, and again, I'd say this episode's full of spoilers, you learn that, like, how calculating he is to killing his father with Phasma, and, like, all these different things to put him in the position he's in. It's really interesting to see him just be put on, and someone has to be like, he's messing with you, especially when you kind of realize that when he calls him a pasty white guy, you know, like, it's really funny. So yeah. I think the holding for Hux is just the attitude that sets up Poe Dameron. And I think without that, his frustration with Holdo wouldn't be warranted, because it shows you his personality and him being kept in the dark is why he's that way. So it's interesting, because I think if you look at like his growth over the film as a whole, like I said, I think he had probably as much growth as Rey or as Luke or as Ben or, you know, any of them that had big story arcs in here. Because you mentioned it earlier, Ben, that it's not just the story of Rey, it's a ensemble class, you know, story. And it really is. It's actually the story of light versus dark, which is what it's always been, because you see it on multiple fronts this time. It's not just one focused on one character. But it's one of those things where his growth from being that headstrong, someone who's going to, you know, essentially be kind of cheeky to a, you know, in front of a dreadnought to General Hux, and then go and, you know, use his skill as a pilot to kind of get himself out of it, to someone who is becoming a leader, which is obvious at the end of the film when they all look to Leia and she's like, no, follow him. Like, he knows, like, he's grown that way. And not going to, like, when, especially when you consider, like, Finn, like, who is one of his best friends that you can, at this point, like, they've got, you know, everything from Finn being goofy and naked and leaking to, to attempt to sacrifice himself when Finn wants to go out and help Luke Skywalker. He can't go by himself. Actually, Poe's like, no.
I think. In this entire movie, the best reintroduction to a character was Finn falling off of the thing after waking up. That was another thing where, like, I'm a huge sucker for slapstick, so, like, I was one of the few who just laughed when he fell off the table.
No, I liked it, too, because John Boyega is such a good comedic actor. I mean, actor, period. Actor too. But yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
But I do think I'm a little sick of talking about Poe. just to talk about Hux for a second. I think it's interesting that he goes. I said this before we started recording, but like, I think it's interesting that like in The Force Awakens, he is the guy who like you're kind of laughing at, but the movie doesn't really let you because he's also slaughtering billions of people at the same time,
trillions, multiple planets,
trillions. Yeah, but one of my biggest problems with Force Awakens, but in this movie, it's kind of like, no, it's okay. He is as ridiculous as you think he is. But it's also interesting that, like, once Kylo makes the flip and becomes the Supreme Leader, Hux gets a little bit less ridiculous. And, like even he, you know, he actually gets, like, a line that we're laughing with at the end, where he's like, are you sure? Do you think you got him? You know, like, it's less.
I was going to say, I would just say, talking to, like, look at Hux when he finds Supreme Leader Snoke and Kylo Ren line there. Like, he goes to pull his blaster and kill Kylo. Yeah. Like, you see he has that ambition, and then Kylo gets up. And he's like, the Supreme Leader! And, you know, Kylo lies, but it's like, you know, no. And just, like, starts force choking him. Like, it's such an homage back to the original film of, like, Vader releasing him, but now Kylo has become, you know, has ascended, if you will, to his rightful place as the Supreme Leader, which I think that we kind of probably saw that it was supposed to be going that way, but the way it got there was not the way I would have expected it to be, him being the big bad. And he's not hiding behind a mask anymore, which is really interesting, which I like.
Yeah. I mean, I just I think that, like, the idea, sorry if you can hear people talking in the next room. The idea of Kylo becoming the big bad this early is really interesting to me, because
same, it's agreed,
totally different. And that's something I'm totally on board for, as much as I enjoy him. I think it makes it's a perfectly sensible villain. Sorry, now I'm talking about Kylo Ren, but I think, you know, it grows from what we were talking about. Like, he is the guy who, like, assesses all sides of the problem through his not particularly sensible and messed up lens, and picks a side. He picks a team, you know, and that team he picks is mostly me, you know.
Yeah, I'm always,
you know. But I love the way that played out, because I really
like a Batman in that kind of way.
Yeah, and because, like, if you think about it, like, the prequel trilogy is like Vader ascending, right? Like, so we have all these other villains, like, the, you know, the Emperor is becoming also a villain, and so Vader is like the villain, but he's, you know, shadowed by the Emperor. And then in the original trilogy, it's like Vader's the big bad, and then it's like slowly you realize, oh no, he's not. There's a bigger bad, and that becomes, you know, the ultimate conflict. And now it's like I assumed that, like, Snoke was going to be the biggest bad for the course of the trilogy, certainly at least through most of it. And then, no, he's not. We get this character that we know intimately, and we have an entire movie coming up of him being the bad guy, or the major antagonist.
I will say, you know, the way he dispatches Snoke, very reminiscent of Darth Maul in Phantom Menace. You know, I feel like there's a little plane there, yeah, cut in half, and literally, oh, yeah, the falling apart.
Darth Mauled him.
I mean, Darth Mauled him. I think that's kind of the. I think that's the verb for it. Darth Mauled him.
Yes,
he definitely did.
Which means Snoke can come back in a TV show.
Okay. Yes. You never know. Hey, you never know. Anyway,
with his mechanical spider legs.
Yeah, no. It's gonna be his legs that are back, but his top body is gonna be mechanical, because it can't be the same thing as Darth Maul. Anyway, let's talk about Rose and Finn, since we started talking about Finn and then we got sidetracked here. Mm-hmm. I just want to bring it on real quick. So
I'm not worthy. Rose is perfect.
Rose is amazing. Rose is amazing. Can I tell you the hero worship that Rose had when she first meets Finn was like the best thing I've ever seen. Like, she's like, oh my gosh, you're a hero of the resistance, and I'm like, that's how I would be.
I just love his may the force be with you, like, he's trying to, like, please a fan. that killed me. I was like, this is great. And then she's like, wait, you're escaping, zap.
But it's, like, doubly awful, because, like, this meeting Finn has, like, lifted her out of her grief for a moment. Yeah, and right. She realizes that he is, like, not the guy she thought he was.
Well, I don't know. Like, it's really, I find the whole meeting of them really interesting, because, like, she's definitely going through grief right now, obviously, you know, with her sister and stuff like that. And unfortunately, we don't get much relationship with her sister, other than that they had a conversation before, and that we know her sister just passed away. And it's meant to be very obvious with the medallion that they wear, right, that they are sisters. Like, you put the connection together. I think that was a really good stroke of genius to be able to tie them together. Part of it,
and this is a testament to the storytelling, but, like, had she not been Rose's sister at the beginning, I still felt the weight of that sacrifice, the way that scene was put together.
Mm-hmm.
And also, just, you know, as a music nerd, Rose's theme plays over her sister when she sacrifices herself, which you don't realize until you hear Rose's theme later in the movie. But I was like, ooh, thanks, John.
Yeah, no, I've downloaded the soundtrack, actually. It may be part of the audio from this episode. But I will say, it's definitely one of those things where I do like that it was all tied together. But her relationship with her sister, I'm excited to read Cobalt Squadron, because I know that just came out today and I haven't got a chance to look into it. I was like, no, I'm not going to start reading at 1 a.m. I got to rest, you know, other responsibilities. But it's one of those things where I definitely want to dive into that relationship with her. I do like that Rose is the perfect embodiment of the resistance. Mm-hmm. She really is. Yeah. And
she's a nobody, which is awesome.
Yeah, like, well, I think the nice part about it, she kind of almost reminds me a little bit of like Lando Calrissian. Lando Calrissian, in that sense, like, kind of comes out of nowhere to become, like, a big leader. Like, she starts off the film by seeing Finn and him being the hero of the resistance to her becoming a hero, obviously in a smaller way, because their mission to Canto Bight was a fun detour, which I really enjoyed for the sake of getting us off the ships and not on Octu. But it was completely a failure, other than that they survived, which was nice. But I like
I do not like the cantina, like the casino.
Let's talk about that for a second. Yeah, okay, I love Canto Bight. I loved what they shed light on in there, because that's obviously a bigger commentary on why things are the way they are in the universe in Star Wars. But I will say I like that her victory, if you will, or her heroic deed that she does is actually recognizing what the resistance is and saving Finn at the very end when he's ready to sacrifice himself. And then they kiss.
Also, I liked her. I don't know. I don't want to. I'm in no way trying to take anything away from Rose, but I liked how her story paralleled Rey's, where she's a nobody who runs into the main story that's going on and then is just like, yep, I'm ready. Let's do this. And then kind of goes and. I mean, she and Rey both run into Finn.
And Finn's story is Finn's a nobody. He's a number. He's
exactly. And so it's so cool. Yeah. And then just the fact that I know we're not talking about Rey yet, but you know, now that this movie, it's kind of like Rey's a nobody. Rose is a nobody. You know, her sister. This movie is a movie about like how the average person can be heroic, which I thought was great as like an overall theme. Because then you have Luke saying like, you know, you don't need to be a Jedi to have the Force. Which translates to you don't need to be special or have status as a person to like be able to make a difference or like be important.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that I really loved about, and I think the thing I loved about the Canto Bight stuff specifically, is that Finn has had a very specific upbringing through the First Order in respect to like what he understands and what he values in the universe, so he sees Canto Bight as this place of excess and escapism and being able to get there and is like, this is insane, this is like ostentatious, it's over the top, it's incredible, and you know, Rose has to bring him back down and be like, yeah, on the surface, but if you look closer, you can see what this is built on the back of. Like, it may be beautiful, it may be luxurious, it may be incredible, but the importance of the Canto Bight stuff is that the First Order and the Resistance, well, it's mostly the First Order, I would say, like, they're not the only ones who profit from making war. The Resistance, I feel like, go through a significant amount more loss in respect to trying to bring sort of like make the galaxy equal kind of thing, but the First Order are not the ones that are generally profiting from the war. Yes, they're getting like significant control of the galaxy, but the people who are winning are the people that go to Canto Bight. Those are the people that profit from both sides of the war, from selling weapons, from selling ships, from, you know, taking the people who've been displaced by the First Order and forcing them into servitude. You know, that there is extreme wealth on Canto Bight, but also extreme poverty. And it shows that side of the war that people often forget actually exists. And for me, that's why the Canto Bight stuff was really important to see.
Right.
Even though on the surface it was very superficial.
I also thought it was nice. Well, nice. I thought it was a good story point that they showed that they not only supported the First Order, but they, you know, supported the Resistance as well. It was just about, it was about money. It wasn't about which side you're on and which one's correct.
Yeah.
Which I thought that was good, because I was like, oh, these guys are First Order money people, you know, like. But then when you realize, no, they just want to make money, they don't care. I was like, okay, I like that touch.
Yeah, my favorite thing about Canto Bight is that it kind of goes back to what we saw in the prequel trilogy with the Separatists, They wanted
it's
to separate.
Very, very Lucas to me.
It's very George Lucas like, and I like that because it also brings up a way for Rose. Like I mentioned earlier, that Rose is like the embodiment of the Resistance because she lived through the hardship, and that's why her and her sister joined the Resistance to make a difference because they were oppressed by the First Order and what happened. And when she looks at it, like, but look at what here. It's like, I will say, I thought it was beautiful. I thought it was great. Canto Bight. It felt like a high level cantina than what we saw at Maz's castle or at the cantina and Mos Eisley, or even what we saw in Cloud City. Like I felt like it was a really high class type thing that looked really amazing, and I love that they had like essentially horse racing with the Fothiers and stuff like that. Like I like that idea, but then when you look at like living in Kentucky, I've been exposed to horse racing at a level that I've never had before when I grew up in California. But seeing like the way that they treat horses here, like which they treat them really, really good, and seeing how the Fothiers were being trained by these kids and being built on, like Donya said, they are, Canto Bight was built on the backs of what the First Order oppresses. And Rose being able to point that out to Finn and kind of see the dirty underbelly of something that has all this glitz and gloss on it. Like, I liked that in their story. And like I said, the whole thing with Canto Bight, like, I like that as a distraction from what we saw the rest of the film out. Because again, you have to remember, this entire film takes place right after The Force Awakens and over a very short period of time. There's the battle, then they escape, and then they're tracked through light speed, and then they're running out of fuel. Like, it's this 18-hour window of them running out of fuel that this whole thing takes place on, which I think is just kind of awesome.
And also, I think the thing that also ties the story to Canto Bight even more is the fact that that last scene in the movie, we're kind of like, oh, okay, and so who knows what's going to happen with that, but, this kid lives on Canto Bight, so it's not the last time we're going to see this kind of side of the galaxy, which is, I think, is exciting.
Yeah.
So here's my problem with Canto Bight, and it's not that I don't agree with all of you, honestly, about the social commentary and the value of having it theoretically in the movie, but I think that this movie is too long, and I do not like storytelling devices that are like, you must unlock this thing to unlock this thing to unlock this thing, and like that. This to me is like a typical, like, well, we need them to be somewhere else, so we'll have them go on this like wild goose chase to a place that doesn't matter plot wise and like, again, I'm not like, I really do agree with you about the thematics of it, but I think that the movie is too long to support it, and I don't like, I if I was watching it independently, I'd be like, hey, cool, this is a great little episode in a Star Wars universe, but I don't like that the whole thing is basically just there to preoccupy them, and then like it comes back around in the end, but not.
Yeah, really? I think it was really there to get them onto Snoke's ship so Finn can have a showdown with Phasma. I think they wanted to have that, and I think that was the plot device to do that. Now I will say, if you want to talk about a plot device that I didn't like that was in there, as much as I love the character, the whole conversation with Maz Kanata sending him to that, I thought was kind of like, well, there you go. That's how they get to Canto Bight. Like, it was, they threw Maz Kanata, who is obviously not actually with the Resistance, but dealing with a labor dispute, which I thought was great. But like that's the kind of like, okay, well, that didn't need to be there. They could have come up with another reason to get over to the ship. But that point right there is what got them to Canto Bight, which got them to Snoke's ship, which is what I think their whole point was. Because I do think you needed to have Finn come face to face with what happened. He needed to come face to face with Phasma. He needed to be presented to Kylo Ren and Hux and everyone being like, call him a traitor, because they all know who he is. But moving on from Finn and Rose, let's talk about Rey and Kylo Ren real quick. So,
do that quickly. That's fine.
Yeah, All right. Well,
not much to say.
For the next 20 minutes, let's talk about Rey and Kylo Ren. I will say, I was a little surprised about Luke not wanting to train Rey at all and kind of just throwing the lightsaber over his shoulder at the beginning, I'll tell you this. I was telling my wife this after the movie. My biggest problem with the new trilogy is that Luke, the portrayal of Luke, is so different from what we saw in the... It's so different from the original trilogy, but like I can see how he gets to where he's at, and he's so different from the Luke in the extended universe. Now, I know EU is Legends and stuff like that, but when you look at like... Has anyone read The Legends of Luke Skywalker, the book?
No, that was the only one I hadn't, because it wasn't specifically linked into...
Okay, so...
Last Jedi.
It's weird, because The Legends of Luke Skywalker made me like Luke Skywalker a whole lot again, because it reminded me of Luke from the extended universe. And I thought Luke in this film was nothing like Luke from the extended universe, nothing like Luke from the original trilogy. I can see how he gets there. This story does a really good job of explaining how Luke that we see is the Luke the way he is. But, you know, my joke, you know, last night I was telling my wife was, you know, the difference between Luke in this film and Luke from the extended universe is he's got a beard. Because in all the extended universe film, like books and everything, it's Mark Hamill, like aged Mark Hamill without a beard. And so it's like, you know, so in my mind, I always pictured Luke growing older without a beard. But like that's just like, it's obviously a cosmetic thing. But like the unwillingness to teach, especially when like Yoda hit it on the nose, is like, you never passed on what you've learned. He tried to and failed. But like, if you think about Luke Skywalker, like think about Luke from like Empire Strikes Back, Return of the Jedi. And I guess you have to take that he had such a hubris, like, and he mentions it. He was so, he became a legend. So he was essentially full of himself, saying, oh, you know, how can I fail? How can I fail, you know, at teaching a new generation of Jedi? And when he does, he doesn't learn anything from it. But when you look at Legends of Luke Skywalker, he is all about learning and not being a limelight. And, you know, there's a story that is so, like, so contradictory to what we know. It's an obvious story. And it's Luke there listening to the story. He's like, so this is how it really is. And he's like, well, why didn't he ever correct them? He's like, why? Like, he's a legend for a reason. But the legend is different than the person. And so, like...
I mean, it's a legend.
I know. That's the whole point. And like I said, like, the Luke not training Rey and not wanting to come back... And having such a bar into it, it seemed really, it wasn't far-fetched, but it was something that I had to kind of, you know, essentially suck up and say, okay, that's Luke Skywalker. But that's not my Luke Skywalker. You know what I mean? Like, does that make sense?
I respectfully disagree in that the Luke Skywalker that we see in this film was absolutely the direct evolution of the Luke from the original trilogy. There was enough of original trilogy Luke in there that had grown up. And I saw it in his humor, in how he was behaving, how he was reacting. That was original trilogy Luke.
But see, here's the thing. It's like, I would say the humor is not Luke. That's Mark Hamill. Because like, if you look at the original trilogy, Luke is naive.
Funny. Whoa, wait a second.
Hold on. No, Luke's naive though.
Hold on. Like, here's the middle ground argument. Yoda prequel versus Yoda Empire Strikes Back. Yoda goes crazy too because he's been alone for a long time. And I'm thinking maybe the same thing happened to Luke.
I mean, I didn't necessarily see Luke as crazy. I saw Luke as very realistic. You've got to remember Luke in the original trilogy, what he knew about the Jedi in general was very limited and filtered through Obi-Wan and Yoda. So he was building a Jedi Order based on an ideal that he didn't understand. So absolutely, it makes so much sense that
sort of Wizard of Oz kind of take on it.
Yeah, so it absolutely makes sense that his Jedi Order was built and trained around this idea of like a chosen one, like, coming up, because that's what he'd been taught and told. Like, there's a very specific lens of the Jedi that Luke knew. Now, the fact that he got to Ahch-To afterwards and read the original Jedi texts and found out more about...
He flipped through them.
He flipped through them. But, like, in that time since his Jedi Order ended, he had clearly learned more about the original, like, the Jedi Order and what it actually was, and realized, oh my god, this isn't anything that I want.
Well, and that's... And that's exactly what The Legends of Luke Skywalker has, is it has a bunch of stories of Luke going and learning about the Jedi Order from various things and learning about the Force from various things. But like I said, like the portrayal of Luke here, I can see how he gets there, but it's a direct contrast to what I grew up reading, you know, from second grade on of all the EU books and everything. And it's definitely a very different take on where Luke went after Return of the Jedi.
I feel like the Luke that we get in The Last Jedi is a more natural progression from original trilogy Luke than the Luke in the expanded universe.
See, I think that Luke here, I mean, like, I agree with you, Donya. I think it might actually be, like, it depends on how attached you are to Luke as a character and, like, you know, either Legends or your own idea. Like, I have friends who are, like, who reject even the idea that Luke would, you know, check out from the galaxy at all. And I don't agree with that. I think that you know, the operative change is trauma here, and, like, the fact that Luke experienced such a horrendous thing, which we even realize is even kind of worse than we thought, because, like, obviously the trauma not only of what of what Ben does, but the trauma of his own instinct to murder his nephew, you know, has clearly made a tremendous impact on him. So for me, it's almost less what we've seen him go through and more what we're told he's been forced to experience, you know, ever since Jedi.
Yeah, and that's why I said, like, it makes sense. Like, I can see him getting to this point, but it's so different. Like, if that trauma is what makes Luke the way he is and why he closes himself off from the Force. But, like, I don't know, like, I do like that when we see Luke that there is three flashbacks, retellings of it. And like I said, for me, it's like from a certain point of view. You have the first one where there's the clash between them and Kylo pulls it down and Luke is not at fault at all. Which is the very first one. And then you have the one from Kylo of, you know, Luke was going to murder him and he barely, barely survived. And then you have what actually happened and Luke realizing his failure. And that right there, that is probably the most poignant thing that I think happened in The Last Jedi about Luke's character, because that does, his failure right there where he ignited his lightsaber and he fell there. I think that's his biggest, like, thing that would drive him to where he is now and makes him believe it. But it's one of those things where I think when he talks about the Jedi, you know, I think him arguing about the Jedi, what is their biggest, you know, what are the Jedi? Like, why do they need to end? Was because at the height of the Jedi Order, they allowed a Sith, Darth Sidious, to take over and create the Empire. And I think that's exactly it. It's the arrogance of the Jedi, which we saw in, you know, Revenge of the Sith, and we even see it in Clone Wars and stuff like that, where the Jedi had lost their way. And him going back, searching for learning about the Force from various things in Legends of Luke Skywalker, and even coming back to Ahch-To, where he's got the original Jedi text, he's learned so much about it that he just doesn't feel like that their legacy, like, even leading up to it, no matter how good it was, it wouldn't matter. And I think it is something where Rey and him have this kind of battle of kind of finding out, does she actually want to learn from him? I do like that she ends up getting the books at the end and does train a little bit, you know, with him. Like, he gives her three lessons for her to learn everything, which kind of reminds me of, like, Yoda and Obi-Wan's teaching to him. Like, with very minimal training, Luke became a Jedi, whereas same thing with Rey, with minimal training, she became someone who was able to confront, you know, Snoke and Kylo, even if it was something where in Empire you have Yoda telling Luke not to go confront Vader because she's not ready, Luke telling her not to go confront Ben, but she does anyway. Like, she believes what she knows is right. Does that make sense?
I think there's also a case to be made that, like, you know, she has the books and Luke is probably going to be to her what Obi-Wan was in ghost form.
Definitely seeing Force Ghost Luke. And
Luke will exist. I mean, because, heck, we got Force Ghost Yoda. So, like, you know, there's no way he's not going to be around. Plus, that means he can be on not the island. He can just kind of show up to wherever she is.
Well, he was able to do that anyway. Like, we saw it.
Well, yeah. But I'm saying, you know, when he's blue and glowing.
I mean, like, that scene where he shows up in, like, he manages to project himself, and he was, like, the most extra about everything, and the brushing off his shoulder and taunting. That was 100% original trilogy Luke. Like, the Skywalkers are so extra. And he was in that scene, and I was like,
Luke in the original trilogy, like, give me one example from the original trilogy where you would say him brushing off would be a characterization of Luke. Give me one example from the original trilogy. Not Anakin, but Luke. I can't think of a single one.
I think you can translate that into, like,
that's Mark Hamill. Like, that is 100% Mark Hamill.
I think that type of humor probably stems from, like, his whiny personality. Like, you know, there's like a, it's like two sides of a coin. It's like he's whiny in some cases, then in others he's like, oh yeah, like, I'm a Jedi, you know, drop the mic.
Well, it is something like this movie does capture Luke's petulance in more ways than one, I think. And that is,
don't change,
I mean, Jedi Luke is my favorite. Like, Return of the Jedi Luke is my favorite. And this is not Return of the Jedi Luke, but it's got some elements in there. The thing about the humor for me is, like, I feel like we'll get used to it. You know, there's a lot of stuff that,
like,
you know,
I get my whole thing is, like, I get how he can get there, but I can't say it's original trilogy Luke. Like, there's so much removed from it. Like, when you look at, like, him, you know, brushing it off, Luke is naive in the original trilogy. Like, he's like, the Force, what is the Force? Like, he wants to learn. Like, he's this eager young boy. Now, again, Luke is my favorite character. Like, that's who I identified with from growing up. Like, as much as I love Han Solo and Lando, like, and I love Lando Calrissian, but Luke has always been, like, my character. And I think that's why I have this hard time, like, identifying some of that stuff with it. But at the same time, like, I get how it can get there. Like, I'm not saying that it's not possible, but when I say, like, when you say, like, the brushing off the shoulder, I'm like, that's a humor from the director and Mark Hamill, and I feel like I love that it was there, but that's not Luke from the original trilogy.
See, I think a lot of the stuff that he did when he was, like, fighting in, like, Jabba's palace, and the way that he set up, like, how he made his entrance there, and how all of that worked out, like, that was super extra. Do you not think that was, like, really over the top?
Well, I think that it wasn't over the top in the sense that they tried multiple ways to see if they can I think it was a well thought out plan by him, Lando, Leia, different things, because, like, think about it, if Leia had been able to succeed in getting Han out, would Luke have ever showed up? Like, the point there, like, I get, like, him showing up as a Jedi, but he came up, you know, in a robe cloak, trying to negotiate, trying to use a Jedi mind trick, a simple thing, so he didn't have to fight, you know. And then obviously it falls into, like, his, you know, he not knowing how the full Force works, he realized that the Jedi mind trick only works on those weak-minded, and Jabba's not, so he failed. You know, so there's a lot in there. I think we need to revisit Luke Skywalker as a spotlight topic, especially now after we see The Last Jedi and his death. But I think it's one of those things where I think there's a lot there. Like, I didn't think Return of the Jedi Luke was over the top, especially when you consider, like, him, even, like, when you look at the later characterization when he's on Endor, he's worried about endangering the team, and he just turns himself in. Like, nothing in that is over the top. That's more kind of like at the end of Luke, like what we saw at the end here, where he was at peace when he passed on. Like, that, I will say, the end of Luke, like, you know, kind of passing on and fading to the Force, moving on. Like, that's a characterization. I believe that 100% of Luke. But the kind of being turned off. Now, again, I have to remember that he had the betrayal and, like, the failure in himself, and he cut himself off. Like, to me, I can see that happening. I can see how he gets there. But some of the things, like, I just don't see it as being an original trilogy Luke. But again, that's because I have that strong connection. Like, he's always been my favorite character on that.
Yeah, I mean, he's always been mine as well. Him and Leia were always my favorites. But I think my interpretation of Luke is entirely different from yours. Which is interesting.
I was in kind of a middle ground with the whole thing, because, like, I know I went in, well, we go in with Rey's perspective. We're like, oh, Luke, like, the legend. And then, you know, it's like a pull back the curtain. It's not actually the Wizard of Oz we thought it was. So let's deal with what we've got. And then you as the viewer, and I think that's probably where a lot of people are going to divide on this movie and specifically is because like they're like, no, I want my original trilogy Luke. But then there's the others who are like, immediately they throw that thing out the window and they're like, oh, okay, I have to accept this and move on because he's grown into, you know, a different person because of what's happened. So like in that way, I'm kind of with both of you.
If anything, I feel like Luke is a mashup of Luke Skywalker that we know, Han Solo, with the... I think the brushing off and the kind of the humor is more Han Solo than Luke. And
really?
Yeah. Because that's how Han always was, the smooth talker, kind of joking and stuff like that, whereas Luke was, like I said, Luke was always more naive. Even when Luke's like a Jedi Knight, Han, like, Luke's a Jedi, like, he would laugh at that.
I mean,
but at the same time, he's also, hold on. He's also a mashup of Yoda too. He's also become kind of grouchy. And you know, when you first meet Yoda, he doesn't want to teach Luke. He's like, no, he can't, but he kind of does. So I feel like Luke is a mashup of himself, a little bit of the humor of Han, cause there is no Han in this film. And then you have, you know, a little bit of Yoda in him, which obviously Yoda shows up and inspires him again. So I don't know.
It's the same guy who basically says to Jabba, that's the last mistake you'll ever make. Like, he's very over the top in some of what he does in the original trilogy. So, and he is, to an extent, once he becomes a Jedi, a little cocky. And not in a bad way, though. That's the thing, is I don't mean this in a bad way at all, but, like, there is an aspect to Luke is a little cocky in terms of his ability, you know, and that's not a bad thing. So I just saw this as an evolution of the seeds planted in the original trilogy.
Okay.
You know, he spent that whole conversation with Jabba being really rude, really over the top, really cocky and smirking through the whole thing. You know, that go back and watch it again, because he...
Oh, I just watched all of them. I agree. No, like, yeah. I don't think he was smirking, because like, I think he had one plan. He had contingency plans through the whole thing. Like, his conversation with Jabba.
Hold on. I'm going to drop a gif in, then, to the lot. You don't think that's a smirk? This gif?
But I think, but that's one frame out of him talking. That's not that's specifically taken to kind of portray one view of it. And I think if that's what you're taking it from, that's definitely going to cloud your opinion of Luke. You know, I don't think think about it. He came in with it, you know, he came in using excessive force. Force choked the Gormarian guards. Like, if we're going to talk about him in Return of the Jedi. And then he uses his Jedi mind trick on Bib Fortuna to get an audience with Jabba. So like,
yeah,
but those
shoulder brush is one moment in that whole scene. The rest of it, he was stone cold badass. But that shoulder brush is that one little smirking, cocky moment.
I like that. But my point is like the whole thing, like him rejecting the teach Rey at first and everything. Like that's why I said I feel like he's a mashup of a couple other characters because I can't. It's hard for me to see Luke getting to, you know, being closed off completely from the Force. And I think McCall said it right. Like, we have to remember that there's tragedy there. Whereas when you look at every other characterization of Luke in all the current canon novels and also in the EU novels, he never dealt with tragedy that way. And then the characterization of Luke specifically from that, and then even like the brush off, I just feel like that was a little bit out of place. Now, don't get me wrong. I liked it and I laughed at it because it's definitely something I would probably do, my personality. But for me, it just seemed a little out of place and it was okay with that.
Yeah. I mean, and I'm the complete opposite in which I feel it was entirely in Luke's character and I loved it as a Luke film. Just the whole thing.
So, real quick, I want to get to Kylo Ren and Rey so we can wrap up because we're at a little bit long episode here because I'm sure we'll talk about this again next week. What do you guys think about the connection between Snoke and Rey and Kylo, him bridging their minds together?
I thought it was interesting. I touched on it a little bit earlier in that whole manipulation thing. Like, Snoke, like, planted that seed, but Kylo carried it through. I don't think it was premeditated. Like, I think what makes Kylo so dangerous is that he reacts entirely on emotion and feeling. There is no strategy, there is no rhyme or reason to what he does, he just feels very, very deeply. He is an incredibly emotional character, and that makes him dangerous, because all he does is channel that emotion, which a lot of the time is anger. And there's no preparing for that, there's no planning for that, there's no strategy that you can use to go up against a character like that, because they're so unpredictable. So I feel like Snoke connected their minds, and as they were talking and discussing and going through stuff, he saw an opportunity. Like, a lot of the conversation from Kylo's side is straight out of the abuser's handbook. So it's really interesting in the way that someone who has been abused himself has then used that against another person and used the same sort of things all the way through. So this connection between them was really, really interesting, because as it continued, as it was prolonged, you saw how he was twisting or starting to twist that connection to try and make Rey fall, but in a much darker way than she was doing with him, because what his aim was to wipe out anything and everything to do with their past and move on and basically lead the galaxy. Like, that whole moment between them, when he does that whole thing where he, like, reveals her parents, who her parents were, and kind of says, you know, you're a nobody, you're no one, but not to me. That is the quintessential abuser's way of trying to control someone, of being like isolating them from their support network and moving them away. And I think, like, a lot of Luke's reluctance to train Rey kept her isolated and vulnerable through her grief, which allowed that to happen. It was really, really interesting, because his whole thing was like, you know, no one will understand you the way that I understand you, no one will love you the way that I do, kind of thing. It's that is basically what someone who deals in emotional manipulation does. And it was devastating and awful and horrific, but so, so, so important to see, because it's a storyline and a plot that has gone back so far in Star Wars, because we've seen it done over and over and over again, you know, between Palpatine and Anakin, and then we see it with Ben and Snoke, and then it's starting to repeat itself again in Kylo and Rey. And then that moment where he takes out Snoke, they take out the guards, they're stood there, and he offers his hand to her and is like, let's destroy the past and let everything die and move on. And she's like, no. She stops it, takes control, stands strong in her own convictions, and stops history from repeating itself again.
See, my only thing about that is, I don't see it just where she's stopping it, is he actually tells her, it's like, I'm surprised you don't know who your parents are. Like, in my mind, I actually think she knew, but she buried it because she didn't want to believe it. It's like, it's a hard truth to swallow. Yeah. And he just brings it out. Like, and he doesn't like tell her that to isolate her. I think he's like, I'm surprised you don't know who it is.
No.
Well, in terms of, just to bump in for a sec, there were a couple things that annoyed me, which is that, like, there are scenes, particularly flashback scenes from Force Awakens, that no longer fit into this narrative at all. Like, the scene of Kylo in his helmet, you know, presumably taking down the Jedi school, and then Rey as a child looking up at some crawler or speeder or whatever it is, like flying off and Ankar Platt's holding her hand. Like, to me, those things no longer particularly fit into the story. And well, so I'm a little confused.
And that's why I'm almost like, I don't know if like what he said, like I can believe what she said, but she is just like the daughter of two scavengers from Jakku who were drunks. I can believe that 100% them flying away. But like at the same time, like I agree with you in the sense that like the Jedi Temple, him and the few Jedi Knights that disappeared, what happened to those, the Knights of Ren? Like what happened to them and the whole thing? We have in the original trilogy and in the comic sense after in Rebels that we have the Inquisitors, like the other Jedi from there, you know, the other Jedi that have fallen that Vader is in control of. So like there's a lot of things that I don't, that there's unanswered questions in that specific area. But when you look at, like, Rey and Kylo specifically, I think he's just stating the obvious to her that she should have learned this by now. Because she doesn't...
No.
I think it's there. I think the answers are there for her when it comes to it. But I don't think he's using it as manipulator. I think he's doing
it as... Well, I mean, then why would he say, you're a nobody, you've always been no one, but you're not to me? That's incredibly manipulative.
Well, the thing is, the way I see it is not necessarily that Kylo isn't manipulative, because he is. But I don't think that this whole, like, force bond between them was his idea.
No. Like I said, Snoke planted that seed and connected them together, but Kylo reacts entirely on opportunity and feeling.
Well, the reason I think he does that is honestly, like, I view him as equally as, I don't know if honest is the right word, but, like, genuine in his emotion as when Vader tells Luke, like, you know, join me, we will rule the galaxy as father and son. Together. Like, he basically quotes him. I'm not saying that you're, like, I think that your perspective is totally valid, Donya. I just prefer to view it slightly more sympathetically and say that, like, I think Kylo is messed up as hell and lonely, like Rey is, which is why they see something in each other. They recognize something in each other. And so it's not that it's not manipulative, it's just that I think that manipulation is coming from more of a desperate place than a, like, I want to control you place.
Yeah, I'll agree with you on that, Mikhail.
I mean, I don't disagree with that at all, but it was still, it's a manipulation and an abuse done on instinct and emotion rather than premeditation and strategy, which is a completely different kind of abuse because it's harder to break away from that because there's no real thought put into it in that there's an end goal necessarily. It's happening, which that was the bit for me that was kind of like, oh my god, this is insane. Like, it was like incredibly emotional through the whole thing watching that play out.
Yeah, I think the same thing coming from Rey, though, having seen, like, she tells Luke, even, she's seen his future, he'll turn back, you know, she's convinced, and it's like, it's not, like, I feel like someone's like, it's not him manipulating her, that's actually his conflict in motion. I think there was a point where Kylo Ren could have actually turned back. I think Ben Solo could have been redeemed in this film at one point in time, but we passed the moment, and he went so far the other way. I think it's one of those things where when you look at Kylo Ren and Rey together, they are the same on so many levels, but different in the sense that it's kind of like when Luke went to go redeem his father, he knew there was, and it was his, you know, his son's love for his father that redeemed him, if you will. But at the same time, like, Rey had no connection to Kylo Ren other than their minds were linked and they were seeing it, and they both felt alone. Because they were both isolated in that way. They were both abused separately in very different ways. And Rey, actually having taken the time to learn more about what actually happened, I think she saw more than Kylo did, because Kylo never actually saw the failure that was Luke and only saw the aggression that was Luke in that moment that when Luke created Kylo Ren and the destruction of that. So I think I think it comes down to, like, Snoke being who he is, the linking between their two minds was something that was there to help Kylo go completely dark. But I think it could have possibly backfired if Luke had come back with Rey versus staying on the island, because it's one of those things where Rey had a Force vision. Remember, like Yoda says, the future is not set in stone. Like, it's always changing. And Rey's vision of Ben was equally valid as Ben's vision of Rey going to the dark side. I think they were completely equally valid.
Yeah.
But it's one of those things where with Kylo Ren being manipulated by Snoke the way he was, because he did have more conflict, especially after the death of his father. You know, if you think back to the novelization of Force Awakens and even just what was mentioned in The Last Jedi, you know, even killing his father, Han Solo, I like how they always have to say, when you kill your father, Han Solo, they have to put the name afterwards. In case the audience forgets, it's one of those things where it just brought more turmoil, because I think he was regretful of it, especially like when you look at the fight, you know, the fighter scene when he's angry and upset and he gets in his fighter after he smashed his mask and he has the opportunity to fire on his mom. You know, we saw that in the trailers as a very emotional point. He doesn't fire on it. Like, he actually stops, and even though he knows mom's there, doesn't mean that she wasn't still shot at by the ships that were on his wing, but he specifically didn't fire. Like, he hesitated.
I think that's a very important point also, because I think that after that, Ben goes through the movie believing that Leia is dead and that he has played either a direct or indirect role in killing both of his parents. And I think that that is a big thing that weighs on him. Like, when Rey calls him a monster and he says, yeah, I am a monster, I think that's what he's referring to. He's such a complicated character, and the whole relationship with Rey is so complicated, because, like, kind of all we saw of him in the first movie was darkness, and all we saw of Rey in the first movie was light, and then they both kind of muddle each other in this movie, and it's, like, it's confusing to tease out exactly who, like, until they both end where they end. It's a very complicated and murky relationship, because I think they are both really genuine in what they feel. And, like,
yeah.
I think that, like, Kylo doesn't view the dark side as evil, and Rey is obviously conflicted about what it means to be allied with the Jedi and the light. So it's all really, I don't know, it's all really confusing and messy. And I will say, I loved the conversations between the two of them. I wasn't super keen on how it was done, because it was just like, I felt like there should have been something a little bit more visually there than them both each just, like, talking into space, but I don't know.
Yeah. It's the thing that they say about superheroes and villains, that a lot of the time when you boil it down to circumstance and origin, their origin stories are exactly the same. It's just what you choose to do with it. And it's the same for... It's very much the same for Rey and Kylo Ren, in that a lot of what they've gone through is very similar in terms of their trauma, in terms of where they started as characters, in terms of their view of belonging and family and legacy. They have different baggage in that respect, but the paths are very, very similar. Just what you ultimately choose to do with it. And what makes the most compelling kind of villain is the ones that believe that what they're doing is right, and that they're the hero of their own story. And that, I feel, is what makes Kylo Ren such a dangerous villain, is that he believes and feels that what he's doing is right. And also just the idea that, like, he's just feeling. It's emotion that's driving him. And that's what makes him so dangerous, because how do you plan for that? How do you strategize against someone who's reacting and feeling, and just that's how they operate? Because you can't quantify an emotion down to understand what they're going to do next. And that's why I'm very interested to see where Kylo goes next in the next film. Because it's so fascinating to me, because how are the Resistance going to fight back against that? How do you fight back against someone who feels and doesn't plan?
And when his number one assistant is also one who kind of just gets mad and is power hungry. Yeah,
right.
But. Alrighty. Guys, I know we have a lot more to talk about because we could probably go on for hours on this. I just want to do last thoughts here on the very end after the Resistance starts anew, the Rebel Alliance kind of joins, the Rebels start again. The Jedi techs are in the drawer at the end of The Last Jedi. They weren't destroyed, even though Yoda helped Luke destroy the first Jedi temple. What do you guys think is going to happen next in episode 9? I know this is 2 years away, but fresh off seeing it. Any quick hopes before we wrap up?
Well, I don't know. Were they the Jedi texts in the drawer? I thought I glimpsed them, and I was like, wait, did I actually see that, or did I not?
I think that
see
was
it
on purpose, and I think that's, yeah, I think they were.
Because Luke thinks they're still Yoda in the tree. Knew. Like, he talks about the books. He's like, I'm burning the books, and then he, like, tries to reach in while it's burning, and Yoda goes, nah, ha, 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 ha. No,
Yoda being Yoda. Yoda being Yoda. So
that's
actually, I think
that's
the
exact Yoda quote, too.
Yep. I will say, I'm pretty sure they are the Jedi techs, and I think Luke was not meant to know that they survived.
Here's what I think, and this is something that I thought would happen in this movie, or at least would be set up a little bit more, but I was like, Rey has to be a nobody. We have to see that there are other nobodies in the galaxy who are Force-sensitive, like, in the Jedi kind of way, which we have now, and Rey's going to train them, and they're going to go toe-to-toe with the Knights of Ren in the last movie, which I think could still happen, because nothing has really opposed that yet.
Yeah.
Yeah, because the kid on Canto Bight. Like, was it me? Did he lift that broom
into his
hand?
Yes, he did. He force pulled it. And if you look at his shadow, his shadow was designed.
I thought he picked it up.
The shadow.
So everybody in the theater gasped, and I was like, yeah, he picked up a broom.
I was like,
oh man. And then afterwards somebody's like, no, he like force willed it into his hand. I was like, got it. All right.
And the shadow was also a Jedi. The shadow is also a very iconic Luke Jedi pose shadow, where you didn't see the tail of the broom. You just saw the lights, the hilt coming out, the lightsaber in his shadow. So it was definitely meant to be a new generation coming.
Made me sad, because I was a little bit like, God, there's going to be more war. we just had this whole movie about how, like, war is awful and, like, unbelievably destructive, and you can't fight for those reasons. And then it's like, here's the next generation into the meat grinder.
I feel like when it comes to what Rey does next in terms of what the Jedi will be moving forward, I think that the Jedi as we know them are over. The Jedi Order, how that all works, that sort of thing, how it was structured, is done. We're never going to see that kind of Jedi again. I think what Rey will take is some fundamentals of how they interacted with the Force and start something new. Because she doesn't have that baggage, that legacy, that understanding in the same way that Luke did. There is no connection back to it, so it's untethering from that and being able to break the cycle and move forward. And I feel like that's a lot of what the sort of supplemental stuff has been doing as well. You know, the Jedi as we know them in like Star Wars Rebels are not necessarily like Kanan and Ezra. Their ideals operate very, very differently to the Jedi Order. So it's, and how like the Force users work in Rebels as well, it's like very different. So I think it's like taking steps away and being something that will start anew. And I feel like maybe having the Jedi texts will give her like a little basis of understanding what not to do. rather than being a guide for what to do.
Well, yeah, she, I don't know. She can't be a guide for what to do. She's like,
well, so yeah. That's why she got the books.
Yeah. So she has a guide there, and we'll see Force Luke, I'm sure, for this. I'm hoping that, like you said, Ben, I agree with you. I hope that Rey goes on and has a new generation of Jedi, which is what Maz Kanata has said that needs to happen. The Jedi must rise again. Like, so I want that to happen. Kylo Ren is now Supreme Leader, which he is gone. There's no redeeming right. him. Leia has even said her son is dead. So I we're going to see that ultimate battle between good and bad. Like
that
we
gives
saw.
More, that gives more, I guess, weight to my kind of my want for there to be the Knights of Ren to come back, because Snoke's out of the way. Kylo Ren is in charge. He'll probably find out that Rey's been training Jedi, and he'll be like, oh, crap, because he knows how powerful she is. And, you know, either he'll try to turn more of, you know, her students, but I'm pretty sure he's got his own little posse, like his little Death Eaters, to hang out with him. And they'll, like, come from the corners of the galaxy. Like he could send out a distress call, kind of like Leia did.
I kind of wonder more on a meta level, like, what episode 9 is going to be like, because, you know, I think we can all like get down on our knees and thank God that Colin Trevorrow is not directing it. This movie was so much a, not a refutation, but it definitely stood, distinctly from, Force Awakens. And that was such a product of JJ and what he was doing. And now that we're going back to JJ, I'm really curious to see how those two come together. Like, what is JJ going to do with these pieces that Ryan has left him?
I also wonder, like, I think we're going to get a time jump. I think we can't go immediate, like, we can't follow on immediately from where we left off this time. No. So we have to move on in a way that, like, yeah, we have to move on in a way that it gives a time jump, because there are things that need to move on, like what happens with Rey and the Jedi and where does that go to, but also how do we transition from not having Carrie in this film when we've ended it where Leia is alive, she's active, she's still in a leadership position. How do we transition from that to whatever comes next, which obviously Poe was being groomed for leadership in this, so I would imagine that where we're going is that Poe is going to have learned from that, and when we pick back up again, he'll have learned more and moved into a genuine leadership position and been affected very heavily by everything that happened with Leia and Holdo in this movie. But what does that mean for Leia?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think there's going to be a time jump. There has to be one. Specifically, not only are we going to see like Poe being the leader of the Resistance, Leia having passed away, Rey's going to be a Jedi now. She will have trained. Whether she started training anyone else, I don't know about that. I want her to have a dual-bladed lightsaber because she's so used to her staff. She just has the crystal. Like, I'm glad that they destroyed the lightsaber, but that's a whole conversation for another day. But I want her to have a dual-blade lightsaber.
The conversation is, where the heck did the lightsaber come from? The one question I wanted answered.
From Moss, I know. We'll get to that. But guys, thank you everyone for listening. If you have any comments, please tweet at us at our radio podcast. We'll probably respond, and depending on how many we get, we may read them on next episode, because there's just so much more to talk about with The Last Jedi. Thank you all for listening to another episode of Resistance Radio. Feel free to reach out to us on Twitter at our radio podcast or on Facebook at facebook.com/resistanceradiopodcast. Remember to visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/resistanceradiopodcast. As always, I am Mikey B.
I'm Danya.
I'm Michal.
And I'm Ben.
And may the Force be with us.
What did you say? You said us.
I know. That's what they used in the movie, the new movie. May the Force be with us.
But I was like,
I know. Yeah, I changed it up. Hey, new movie, you know, new saying. I'm just saying.
Chuck's lightsaber behind him, and then I'm going to leave.
And walks away. All right. May the Force be with you.
And also with you.